Today, he's going to tell us about Beyond Slow Roll and features in Cindy.
Thank you, Kendrick. Thank you for the invitation. So today, indeed, I'm going to talk about work that I've been doing for the last, well, some of the work I've been doing for the last 2 years or so in collaboration with David Spergo at Princeton and Benjamin Wandelt at EIPA. And if time permits, I also talk about some of the work that is in progress with Boriana and Rene Lotek. Is that the right pronunciation, Dottie?
Lotek.
And Joel Myers at CETA, and Moritz Munchmeier at EFA, and also with Ben Wandelt. So just to remind ourselves, what we're trying to do, I guess, as early universe cosmologists, is we assume, foremost, that the initial conditions were set very early on during a process similar to something like inflation. And from that, we have the structure formation at late times, the formation of the CMB. And by inducing, by looking at the structure today, as well as fluctuations in the CMB, we try to reconstruct what happened very early on, right? So that's sort of the line of thought. In this talk, I will have some stuff about large-scale structure as well, but in this talk, I'll mostly talk about the CMB as a probe of the early universe. I guess as a first check, we have this extremely high-resolution map. This is a W map image, V band, which I think is 60 gigahertz. And of course, the first thing you wanna do is when you take another snapshot of the universe to make sure that they look very similar, and that turns out to be the case. So this is the Planck 70 gigahertz, a slightly higher frequency, but as you can see just by going back and forth, these things look very similar. So that's a good start, right? And so by looking at these tiny fluctuations and measuring their correlation functions, we can learn something about the early universe. And so the first thing you can check for is look for the variance as a function of scale, which is plotted. This is taken from the Planck papers. And by carefully analyzing the peak structure, which are determined by the fluctuations in the plasma fluid set by the baryons and the photons before recombination, you get these nice peaks. And it turns out that the cosmological parameters are extremely sensitive to the location and the height of these various peaks, right? So by studying these peaks, we are able to measure cosmological parameters. The most common set of parameters, which is usually referred to as plain vanilla lambda CDM, has only 6 parameters. So that's kind of incredible that you can describe the whole evolution of the universe using only 6 parameters. And we have, in those set of parameters, we have densities. So obviously, we have the baryon density. We have cold dark matter density. We have basically an angular scale on the sky, which can be related to Hubble. And then we have the optical depth, which tells us how many photons were scattered in between the CMB and today. And then we have NS and the amplitude AS. And those are actually the ones that most of the time as early universe cosmologists you're interested in, because those will tell you something about the statistical distribution of fluctuations sourced by whatever happened very early on. So those are the most important parameters. So far, so good, I hope. Then on top of that, of course, beyond the temperature power spectrum, we can look at other types of fluctuations, mainly in the polarization spectrum. So these were actually in a paper by Planck already in the 2013 release showing TE and EE polarization. And hopefully by the end of this month or so, or I guess before one of the conferences that is held in Italy, we'll see the full release. Right, go ahead.
Quick question. 6 parameters is a lot of parameters. But how sensitive are these parameters What's the sensitivity of these parameters to get this incredible fit to the angular power spectrum?
How sensitive are they?
Yeah.
Like, right. So I think that if you, I don't know by heart how much the fit changes, but I would say that if you, for example, double the baryon density, right, you get a vastly different spectrum. Like that's really, really different from what we observe. Is that what you're trying to? Is that what your question is?
Well, sorry. If you do theoretical physics and you fit data,
right,
you can fit a carbon and elephant's tail with 6 parameters.
Right.
However,
right,
some of them are much more important than others. You see what I'm getting at?
You mean, for example, if I would just take away one of these parameters, would it still be a reasonable fit?
Yeah.
I would say. I think it. Let me see which one. I guess. Well, I mean, if you take away NS, you could probably cover some of that with tau. No? Would you not be able to do that to some extent?
So we need 6 parameters.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Right. Right. So that's the bare minimum. Is that basically the statement? Yeah. Right. So in any case, and I guess which actually would be interesting to note here is that these observations, although we have no idea how correct they are, because they said not to use them in any way, but the interesting thing here is that the red line is actually set by the measurement that was done on the TT power spectrum, and then they actually computed the associated TE and EE power spectra, and they go straight through these lines, which makes it, you know, rather remarkable. All right. Of course, then there was this claim of B-mode polarization detection by the BICEP collaboration, which of course led to a lot of excitement in the community. Probably also, I don't know, like at least 500 papers were written about it, and then of course some people were skeptical and did some analysis of what could possibly also mimic this signal. And so the question is whether this result will stand. And if you're sort of unbiased, which is very hard, I suppose, then looking at the dust paper by Planck, it's very likely that at least some of this signal comes from polarized dust, right? But in any case, it does show that we have extremely sensitive experiments, and that should be hopeful for the future, I would say. So on top of that, we can go to higher order statistics. So instead of looking at the variance, you can look at the skewness. And that's usually referred to at the bi-spectrum in Fourier space. And you can get some numbers out. So these numbers are simply an overall amplitude that you find in the bi-spectrum. So mode by mode, the data is not sensitive enough. So you can't really measure the exact bi-spectrum mode by mode, but like you would have for the power spectrum. But you can instead sort of get an overall estimate of the amplitude of the bi-spectrum. And of course, when you do that, you have to assume a particular shape, right, in order to actually measure what's underlying the data. And so there are various shapes which are driven by theory mostly. And so these are the most common shapes known as local, equilateral, and orthogonal. And they're all consistent with zero. That's basically the main message, right? And so we can hope for that in the full sky release, the full data release of Planck, these will be more tight. And I guess if you want to know more about that, you should ask Kendrick. He probably has some idea of where these numbers are going. Of course, you can look at other types of bispectra, and in particular, there's a set of bispectra that has tiny oscillations on this sort of almost smooth spectrum, and these are not caused by the BAOs. These are sort of primordial oscillations, so they also are driven by precisely the same physics that that leads to oscillations in the power spectrum. And so the interesting thing, of course, which is it's kind of a statistical expectation, is that when you sort of take a vastly different frequencies and phases, you find one that's almost 3 sigma, right? But nonetheless, it might be, you know, it might be something there for real. Oh, non-Gaussianities. Yeah, sorry, that's just. Oh, that's the type of estimator they use to actually get these numbers out. So that's named after Komatsu, Spergel, and Benjamin Wandel, who were the first to write it. Yeah, so that's why I put it between brackets for those to recognize it. Because you can also use other estimators such as modal expansion, and so these are the numbers that are driven by that experiment. So what we know, I would say, I mean, of course, that can be debatable, and of course, I mean, we have to wait for even more precise measurements. But at this point, the fluctuations that we find in the power temperature power spectrum are very small, which we can just see by eye, basically, because it's so only a small fluctuation compared to the mean. The fluctuations are statistically isotropic, at least if you try to fit for statistically anisotropic modes, you don't find evidence for that. We find that they're almost Gaussian with FNL equals zero, so that's the total amplitude. Of course, it depends on what shape, but at least for the most popular shapes, it's consistent with zero. They're nearly scale invariant, so basically there's no scale dependence whatever cost inflation, at least it was very, very close to the sitter. And they're correlated on super horizon scales. So if you compute the correlation between T and E, for example, you find that they're correlated over scales that were super horizon at the time the CMB was formed. And as far as we know, well, okay, so then the last statement would be that they're predominantly scalar at this point. That depends a little bit on how much you trust the bicep results, right? And so I think that if you summarize this, any type of cosmological effort in the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years probably, will be to find any type of deviation from this, right? So they're extremely powerful. So this is nice, but it doesn't really tell you that much, right? So remember, you have 6 parameters in the plain vanilla lambda CDM, and so there's only 2 parameters that tell you something about the primordial physics. And so if you find any type of deviation from these kind of things, it would tell you something about primordial universe, right? And so in this talk, I'll discuss one of these. To some extent, I'll also talk about non-Gaussianities, and I will talk a little bit about R, but mostly I'll talk about this statement about scale invariance, right? So can we actually measure any type of deviation from that with current data, and how would we go about to do that?
I would put a footnote on that. Theoretically well-motivated deviations, because of course you will find deviations if you pick a weird enough statistic and try it.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I agree with that. Yeah, so that's a very good point, yeah. And that's also what I was telling about the 3 sigma detection of an oscillatory FNL. If you try 300 times, you would expect it to have, you know, at least one with 3 sigma. That's basically the statement. But we'll address this, like when we make any kind of statements about detection, we'll address this issue, yeah. So just the outline. First, I'll give a brief theoretical motivation that will not be the main focus of this talk, but I'll discuss two types of physical models that could lead to features. I'll briefly discuss the complications with looking for these types of features and the solution that we propose in one of these papers. I'll discuss some results. I will not go through all results, but just one example. And then I will discuss what we find. In particular, in the light of this sort of look elsewhere effect, or how many, how many attempts you make to actually look for something, or take some weird statistics, and of course you find some deviation from the usual suspects. And then I'll briefly discuss non-Gaussian entities and bicep results. All right, so the status today, right? So if you take that power spectrum that we saw in one of the first slides, in terms of inflationary models, we have this marginalized distribution between the tilt of the power spectrum, which tells you how much skill a variance you have in the power spectrum, in the primordial power spectrum, versus the overall amplitude of scalar modes of tensor modes, and so. This is a nice plot because you can put your inflationary model into it and just see where it falls, right? So it's kind of a nice tool. And so, in any case, whenever you build a model, it should at least fall into this circle, if you will, a semicircle, right? And so every model except for phi cubed, I guess, falls out of it. And phi to the fourth is even higher, no?
Yeah,
it's off the plot. So. And of course, then there's this line which corresponds to the total number of E folds. And so you can just play with that to get it closer to the center. And then, of course, there was bicep. So this was a universe of pre-bicep. When you add bicep to the mix and in the assumption that it's correct, you shift this whole plot upwards, right? So this thing becomes centered around R equals zero. And a lot of things, fall off, right? Except for, one of the things that's kind of interesting is that m squared phi squared is right in the center, or sort of close to the center of this plot. But this, we have to see if this holds. And so I would say that the universe post Planck dust is what we're in now, and we'll have to see until the end of the year once they do that cross correlation. But in the end, so even if you have these two parameters that will tell you something about the primordial universe, what do we really know about the potential, right? So this is just a line I drew, and it could be the potential of the universe. Who knows, right? But what do we really know, right? We have no idea from which direction it came, whether it was maybe some tunneling involved, how long it rolled for, whether it was like 60 E folds or maybe 80 E folds, and the annoying thing is when we measure things using the CMB and large scale structure, we can only measure 10 E folds, right? So we are sort of stuck. We're stuck with this limit. We're confined to sort of only look at part of what happened in the universe, in the early universe, and we have to leave the rest to our imagination, right? And so within those 10 E folds, we know that there's this red tilt, right? So there's less power on small scales, but beyond that, we don't really know that much, you know? So basically, everything else is a question mark. And so the question is, even within this patch, are we able to extract some more information? And in particular, beyond the first few derivatives. So, although we know it's sort of slow roll, right? It has a marginally red tilt. Maybe if we look closer up into all the things that produce the primordial power spectrum or the bias spectrum, any other correlation function, maybe we can actually induce some other features that were unobserved. And this is in light of the fact that if we measure such a thing, obviously. It would be of great importance for your understanding of the primordial universe. So I would say that so typically these features are sourced by some effective sinusoidal potential, and those lead to logarithmically spaced oscillations in the power spectrum. And so I just list a few examples. Axion inflation is an example. I'll get to that in a second. There's this thing called unwinding inflation, which was proposed by Guido D'Amico and others at NYU. And in principle, you could have multiple fields, and if those bends, you can get some localized features, right? So the last example is localized. And generally speaking, you can have some resonance between between a background and the fluctuations, and that could lead, for example, to amplified non-Gaussianity. And for example, for initial state modifications, it would be sourced by the resonance between growing and decaying modes. So it's just, so typically if you get some amplification, it's due to resonance. So one example is axion inflation. So if you want to control higher order operators, you can introduce a shift symmetry. And this is, of course, particularly important if you have large field inflation, where you would have to invoke some kind of fine-tuning for an infinite number of terms. And this is not the QCD axion. It's just simple. It's they call it axion inflation because it has axion-like properties. It also, if you write down the Lagrangian for this, you can also have some decay in inverse decay into photons, which allows you to actually put some constraint on these effects at late times, so in astrophysical objects. And one working example, which some of you in the audience have worked on in the past, is axion monotomy, and this has an effect of sinusoidal modulation. Go ahead.
It's a bit around the top. So, to paraphrase Paul Steinhardt, Kristen, it seems that you could, any data you produce can be covered by self-attention. So, to what extent can you test inflation or falsify?
Well, I think, like, for example, I'll get to this at the end, which is. If you measure a non-zero R, right, then something that could test inflation would be the inflation consistency condition, right? So how R is related, or how the tilt of the tensor spectrum is related to R. That would definitely, because otherwise you violate the null energy condition, and it's something that's very hard to do in inflation. So I would say that that's definitely a test, a good test of inflation. There are models, in fact, if you have some kind of systematic coupling to a gauge field, you can actually get a blue running of the tilt because you produce these tensor modes classically. So it is possible, but it's not, you know, it's not as easy. You know? So I would say that's definitely a good test.
Yeah. The one prediction in inflation is the ratio of R divided by the tensor tilt, which for single inflaton is -8.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
You need to know NT.
Yes, so I'll get to that. Yeah, so but that's exactly my point. So that would definitely be a good test. Like
it's the only one I can see.
Yeah, it's the most obvious one, yes, I would say.
Well, not just only the most obvious.
Okay, it's the only one. All right. So the second but I'll get to this. So the second thing. The second model is initial state modifications. So in principle, if you assume a bunch Davis vacuum, you would actually need to know the UV completion in principle. And so people have worked out what kind of modifications you could have to the vacuum at the onset of inflation. And it turns out, of course, that these things are suppressed by terms that are go like H over lambda squared or so. But for non-Gaussianities, they can actually be enhanced, which was shown by Andrew Tully and Richard Holman, and also I worked on it in the past. And then there's another question you can ask, whether we live in a pure state or a mixed state, right? So this would be a question that might be relevant if we think about the multiverse. So in that sense, it's sort of a physically motivated or theoretically motivated thing to consider. And those lead to oscillations. More generally, I would say that you can invoke some phenomenological or observational point of view, so that's on top of the theoretical motivation I just presented. And the question, I mean, given the set of parameters that we can currently constrain, can we learn something more by just, you know, if we don't know the exact model? You know, what do observation tell us? And do they tell us something that would lead to a different theory? And then I guess that should be completed by the theory that's guiding observation. generally speaking, I would say that, so this, that's why I was saying it's not the only test, which is that if you have some type of model, you want it to sort of predict a set of observables that is unique to your model. So you basically would compute, you compute a set of observables, and they should all be consistent with one another, right? And so if you have some inconsistency, then probably your model is incorrect. So you would have some set of correlated observables. So the models I'll discuss today have these type of effective power spectra, right? Just to relate what we observe, which is the CL, right, to the theoretical templates that I will use. So there is a transfer function that's delta LT, which tells you how the features are projected onto the CNB sky in this case. And so I'll use these two templates because they're sort of the most common type of effects. So there's the one with logarithmically spaced oscillations, which you have in axial monotomy, you have in unwinding inflation, and you have for certain types of non-Munch Davis vacua. And then in principle, you could have these sort of linear oscillations, which can also happen in multi-field type models. It's hard to say how well motivated these models are. So today I will not really discuss these, but just, you know, for completeness, I did analyze them in those papers.
Can you say a little bit more about the physics that gives the second type of oscillation where it's the phase is linear in K?
This one.
I mean, I know that you get the first one if you have something which is sort of regularly repeating in time.
Right.
That shows up as an oscillation in log K. But how do you get an oscillation?
So these have been proposed in, so these are in, for example, in boundary effective field theory, which is, I think, has been debunked. So basically there you have like some time hyperservice, so you break scale invariance explicitly. And so there you can get these type of oscillations. And you can also get them, I think, in some supersymmetry inflationary models. I'm not familiar with those details, but Xingyang Chen has written about these, as well as Richard Easter, where they use these type of spectra. The only thing with those models is that there usually is some kind of envelope, right? So they decay. They're not like continuous. Right. So now, in terms of the issues that we hit when we want to try for these type of effects in the data, which is first of all the associated probability distribution or likelihood is very irregular, and so in technical terms, I would say, I'm not sure if it's really that technical, that leads to slow convergence. So typically, when you search for any type of effects in the data, you have to run like a bunch of spectra and compare them to the data that you have and then give them some weight according to how good they fit. And so when you have oscillations, it turns out that there's many different frequencies. If you slightly modify them or slightly different phases, they're all pretty good fits. So if you run through parameter space, you're not converging to a best set of parameters. And then there's another thing. If you look at any of these models, they typically have an extremely broad range in terms of theoretical prior on the frequency. So for example, for axial monotomy, there's, I think, about four orders of magnitude in terms of the frequency that you might have. And so that means that if you are on the very high end of this frequency, you have to compute this for at very high resolutions, which is extremely time consuming. And so if you do the sort of standard way of looking for these type of features using Markov chain Monte Carlo, then it generally becomes impractical. There are some ways around this using nested sampling, which I'll not discuss. Well, I actually will at some extent, which is much more robust if you have sort of irregular likelihoods. But still, it's still slow. And so we have to address that part. And so that's what we did.
So when you're using a template like this for the power spectrum, you know, you're kind of you're sampling from those parameters.
Right.
You know, like the A in the video that we make or whatever. Is this, and you said, you know, there's this problem because you've got all these different frequencies to look at.
Right.
I've just heard about this, I don't know whether it's useful. There's this thing called Gaussian processes that you can use to generate power spectra, and there you're explicitly looking for features. It's kind of designed to look for features at a particular frequency, and you include more terms. So it's not like a template, like you're
right.
Yeah, but it's an alternative to binning power spectra, where you instead kind of just sample it at preferred frequencies.
Well, I mean, I think that, yeah. So in this case, to some extent, I'm only looking for the theoretical features, right? So theoretically motivated features, so it's sort of fixed. I mean, people have, even the Planck collaboration has worked out, like, what any type of feature you could have, you know, localized. So they have some kind of spline. I think it's very similar to this. So just rebuild whatever the power spectrum could be. But, of course, then you introduce all kinds of spurious parameters, you know, that you have no idea what they mean. They have no physical interpretation. They're just there. So in this case, I think that what you should first try and do is try and fit physical or theoretically motivated models. Yeah. I mean, it's always possible. Yeah, so just to show you what this looks like, right? So this is the power spectrum, and this is the power spectrum that fits the WF9 data with the highest likelihood. And as you can see, it's super highly oscillatory, which, you know, makes some sense because there's some noise and stuff like that, so it's unclear. I'll discuss the significance of this. But as you can imagine, a nice way of parameterizing this is that you have some smooth CL, which we call the unperturbed part, and there's some correction to that, which we call the perturbed part. And so when you run this analysis, you can really do the unperturbed part very fast, right? Because that's smooth. And the perturbed part, you have to, you can basically expand the transfer functions around this oscillatory behavior. So that's exactly what we did, right? So you just tailor expand the transfer functions around the best fit values for your parameters. So in this case, the theta correspond to your lambda CDM parameters. You just pre-compute any type of derivative you have with respect to these parameters of the transfer functions. And then you can write down the perturbed part, right, in terms of the expansion. And that gives you a nice, you know, clean way of including these oscillations without too much effort. And the reason is, of course, because we can pre-compute these things, right? So now, in terms of, you don't have to recompute these sort of super high resolution required spectra. You can just pre-compute them. That, you know, you do that in a few hours on I don't know, 20 cores, and you store those, and whenever you change the frequency, you just call those, and then you basically, I mean, it's just a read-in process, so it's pretty fast, right? And of course, you can easily deal with the phases, right? Because that's just a mix of the oscillator. Right? It's just a mix of a sine and a cosine, right? So that works pretty well. Yeah, so in the next few slides, what I'll show you is a plot of this form. So typically, on the y-axis there will be, sorry, on the x-axis there will be frequency, and on the y-axis there will be improvement, right? And usually that's in terms of delta chi squared, and sometimes that's also written in this form as 2 delta log L, right? That's just for, so, but just think about it as delta chi squared, and then typically if you look in the literature, if there's 3 extra variables, you would need a delta chi squared of order 11 for a 3 sigma detection. Right, so that's for a delta chi square distribution.
So the 3 variables here are frequency, phase, and amplitude of the oscillation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not sure in this case you can use Gaussian statistics to infer what delta chi square is.
Yes. We'll get to that. Yeah. I will. I'll show you that it's not the case. Yeah. So this is So this is this kind of plot. So there's frequency and there's improvement. This is right. I did this right after the Planck release. So it turned out that Planck did do an analysis, unfortunately. So we were building this method, and then they did do some analysis. And so what you see is that there's trillions of peaks in here that are an improvement. There's sort of a few obvious ones at very low frequencies, and then there's this one at high frequency. This sort of coincides with the one that we saw in WMAP. So WMAP, the best fit is a very high frequency. So this is also, again, this is for log oscillations, right? It's not for a linear one. And you get this best fit. So there's a very small amplitude, and there's a phase, and then there's this frequency, which you can relate, for example, to the axion decay constant in axion monotomy. Right? Right. Yes. Yeah. So if you just shift it by a little bit, then the improvement disappears. And that's the reason why it's so hard to look for these things, because if you're slightly off, you're just off. Yeah.
So if you had a model that generated these high-frequency oscillations, then might you expect them to slowly dephase because of deviations from scale gradients?
Yes. Kendrick, you're also always ahead of the game, yes. so we'll get to that, yes. Obviously, yeah, that's one of the things, yeah. And so the nice thing, of course, this is what Planck did, this range, so they only go to very low frequencies because they had the issue that I discussed, and of course we had a way to deal with it. But of course there was the first thing you want to do is to do a consistency check. So the underlying one was from Planck, and this is the one that we found using our technique. So there's slightly higher improvements because we run over all parameters, and they fix actually every parameter except for the frequency of oscillations, the amplitude, and A. So that's it makes sense that you get slightly better improvements.
But is that curve underneath the
line? Oh, this is the marginalized distribution, yeah. So that puts more weight to higher frequencies. Yeah, so this is more like a probability distribution.
Okay, so it's not
yes.
Price curve,
it's yeah, yeah. It's marginalized over all parameters. Yeah. So we did like, and then after that, we did higher resolution. We also varied the lensing amplitude, which is sort of a guess because it turns out that if you look at these features at these low frequencies, they could actually affect the tail of your power spectrum, which is where A lensing also has an effect. So we were thinking that maybe there's some degeneracy. And there's a very weak degeneracy, but it does lead to some improvement. So if you compare it to the Planck one, which has like minus 9 or 10, we get almost to not minus 14. so it's not unclear what that meant. Now the second thing is, you know, in terms of consistency, you have some WMAP, maps, and you get something that looks like this, and then you do Planck, and you get something that looks like this, right? So it's completely, they're completely off from each other. This is a much lower frequency, and so the question is, why is that the case? And if you zoom in a little bit on the distributions, right, so there is some, so at the high frequencies, they are sort of the same, so the black one is WMAP, and the red one is Planck. And so they're sort of very similar. They're slightly out of phase. But that out of phase can easily be explained if you realize that obviously you have different cosmological observables. So they slightly will affect the effective frequency that you measure. And here also there's nothing really in WMAP at low frequencies. So that's a very, very obvious that you can see from this plot just by looking in my eye. And then, of course, the question that you want to then raise is, are these things real, right? So we have these measurements, and that's all interesting, but are they actually a reflection of what really happened? And so you can do a bunch of tests. You can use these information criteria, which I'll not discuss. I'll have some backup slides in case anyone asks. And then I think, which is sort of the most robust way of doing things, to just do a bunch of simulations, right? So you just simulate a bunch of universes, and then put in either a signal or no signal and see how likely it is to get these type of improvements. And then, of course, there's some what I refer to as circumstantial evidence, and I'll briefly discuss that, which I think will be clear. So this is exactly what Kendrick was saying. If I actually put in a signal, so this is I put in a signal at frequency of 100, right? So I make a universe, I just run my whole pipeline on that signal, what you find is that you find your inserted signal depending on the amplitude that you put in, And they all have the same noise seed, so that's why you have these sort of similar oscillations on top of it. And you have something that sort of resonates, right? It's sort of like a nice thing, right? And so this is at high resolution. I did the same thing at low resolution, so obviously around the found frequency in Planck, just to make sure that they are a match. And here, so at the low, at the very high frequency in WMAP. And so here you see that you get a delta chi square of 250, right? Which is pretty insane. Right? So you're basically adding all this information, also from the resonance part, I would say.
What is the difference between those three curves? Why is delta chi square so different?
Oh, yeah. So that's because, so this is the amplitude, right? So I just changed the amplitude to, so this is like 1% primordial amplitude and 5%.
Okay.
Oh yeah, so the thing is that if you have a primordial amplitude and a higher frequency, your effective amplitude will be much more reduced. Yeah, so that's why you get a low. As you go to higher frequency, your improvement will just decay. Yeah. and then you compare this to what you observe, and it doesn't look anything like it. Of course, I mean this is like a simulation, so that things look a slightly bit more smooth, but there's no such resonance thing that you see, right? It's kind of a mess. Now, this is the distribution of improvements as a function of frequency. So you basically count the number of improvements, and you bin those. And I think what this plot should show you, so this is for log-type oscillations, is basically the distribution is sort of opposite between Planck and WMAP, where in Planck you have a lot of improvements at low frequency, and in WMAP you have a lot of improvements at high frequency. So the x-axis is the improvement, right? So that's delta chi square. And then you just count the number of bins that have a certain delta chi square.
Bins
So these are bins of delta frequency equals 0.2 or something like that.
Oh, right. So you mean how many peaks are there that drop?
Exactly.
Exactly,
yes.
Improvement is anything less than zero is improvement?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, so that's why, I mean, most of these things have no improvement at all. No, so, yeah. So you have this similar thing for the linear ones, which I didn't really discuss, but just to show you what the distribution is. And there are, I guess the good news here is that the distribution of frequencies is between WMAP and Planck is sort of similar, so you get a lot of improvements at high frequency and not so many at low. So they're more consistent in that sense. So the next thing you want to do is just simulate like one universe without any oscillations, right? So if there's no oscillation in the universe and I do the same analysis, what my distribution of improvements? And so for the linear one, you know, this is just one universe, no? So I haven't done like over a set of universes, but at least there's one of delta chi square of 12, no? I mean, or a bunch. I'm not sure how many are in this bin. But this is only one time, so it's hard to say. And here it goes to 8, right? So now the next thing you want to do, so this is for WMAP 9 noise and cosmic variance and no signal, and I just simulate like 5,000 universes. It's a very sort of simplistic simulation. Well, it takes a while, but you simplify things a little bit. And then what you see is this distribution for delta chi squared, which is kind of crazy, right? It's not a delta chi squared distribution at all. So you get this, I mean, for 3 extra parameters, you get like a delta chi square of 10 on average. Right? So if you have 5,000 universes, you pick one, you know, most likely you'll have at least, you have like the biggest improvement will be delta chi square of 10. And so there's no reason to have, I mean, this is like delta chi square of 15 is not even 2 sigma for these type of effects. All right, and so did the same thing later on a little bit for Planck noise, and I mean it doesn't really change that much. In fact, you get even, I mean, in this particular set of realizations, you even have one that has a delta chi square of 35. Right, this is of course like this is 3 sigma off, but still, you know, you can have this just by noise. And this is the distribution of amplitude. And this is the effective amplitude, so it doesn't really tell you what the primordial amplitude is. And this is the circumstantial evidence I was I was talking about, which is if you do any type of fit to the data, right? If you have some kind of oscillations, you would expect if you look at the improvement as a function of L, right? You would expect it to just go up gradually, right? Because as you fit more and more L, if you fit more and more multiples, your improvement should improve sort of linearly, I would say, no? And so, well, of course, the BAO should have bigger improvement, but you would see something that goes up, like, undoubtedly. And so, for the linear ones, all the improvement is still, like, below any of these types of simulations. This thing, you know, at least goes up to some extent, right? And you maybe even see, like, some kind of BAO effect or whatever you want to call it. And so, for the log one, however, like, basically, there's no improvement. In fact, some fits are worse, right? And then all of a sudden, boom, like at L of 1800, you get this super huge improvement. And so this is the whole, and so this actually led to, because we, when I did this analysis, I also chatted a lot with Raphael Fogger, who also did a similar analysis, and we discussed this because this all comes from the 217 gigahertz map. So if you take away the 217 gigahertz map in the Planck analysis, this thing disappears entirely. So
217 is related. Isn't there a funny feature elevating?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that is just the same.
Yes.
Same,
yeah, it's just the same thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, anyway, so I didn't discuss information criteria, but I can tell you it's a mess. Like, it depends completely on what type of information criteria you use. For simulations, I would say, are these things real? Most likely not, right? So, I mean, if I do simulations, I get something that is extremely similar to what I see. And circumstantial, also most likely not, because the thing doesn't improve as a function of L. So in order to make sure that, you know, whenever Planck comes out with their new set to do this really fast, I actually implemented this in multinest, this whole sort of expansion in terms of the oscillatory features. And now I can just run like a whole simulation, the whole thing, the whole analysis in 16 hours. On 12-core, on a 12-core node, and you can in that module, and it's just be downloaded from my website. You can vary all cosmological parameters. You can improve this, so I only go to zero order, but you can go to first order or second order, whatever you want, and so that's new. And then I'll in the last few minutes I'll also discuss Bicep. So this is the result. Again, I'll show you what Planck had, which explicitly says in their paper, we stopped because it took too long to do any higher frequencies. And so with our code, we can just do it in 16 hours. And we get like something that looks the same up until 100. And then we have the rest. And we have the marginalized distribution as well. So that's nice. And as I said, you can download it and run it yourself. And so what about Bicep? So in light of these type of effects. So we know that if R would have been 0.2, right? Even if it's 0.1, it would actually put some extra tension between what we think the theory should tell us and what we observe, right, at low L. So there's this sort of tension, and people have talked about maybe there's some bubble that we see, or a phase transition, or a tunneling. So it all depends a little bit on whether you believe R of 0.2 or not, but even if R is 0.1, you would still have this kind of tension, which you know would be interesting to explain that from sort of first principles. So if R would be 0.2, and it's still true if R is 0.1, you would have super Planckian displacement of the field, which would violate light bound, and so the question then becomes like, is there a model that can actually resolve these two issues in one go? And actually, such a model exists because axiom monotony would. By inducing such a shift symmetry that I discussed before, it would solve the first, right, because you can get R of 0.2. And maybe if you have some large feature, right, it could also resolve the second one. So this is a question that a lot of people asked. And so I did this short paper where I run through this model at very low frequencies, so it's sort of a long wavelength modulation. And this is the result. So here I run at very low frequencies, way lower than it before. And you get this peak, right? So this is the marginalized distribution. This is the delta NS, so also I use slightly different notation because I'm in this paper, I talk about axion monotony explicitly. I use their type of notation with delta NS as the amplitude. I also had to compute the correction to the BB power spectrum, right? So BB power spectrum can also have oscillations, obviously. So you want to make sure that when you run over this model, you also include those. And so this is the result. And so I don't know, like if you add up all the total delta chi squared and you look at the various components, right? So bicep is improved, right? So this is with respect to no oscillations, right? So bicep will be improved. And even the interesting thing here is, which is, so a lot of people said, well, maybe you have some kind of running. If you have some running, then obviously you can lower the amplitude at low multiple. But the running makes the fit worse at very high L, so at small scales. And so interestingly enough, with this model, you get an improved fitting by having actin SPT, which is kind of remarkable.
When R equal to 0.2 came out, there was a flush of papers on the archive giving potentials that fit. I saw what paper where potential was called a sidestepping potential. And it looked really weird.
Right.
Also, it corresponds to a field theory which is not really normalizable.
Right.
And so the conclusion is that whatever happens to R, you can fit the data with some potential.
Right.
Even though it's weird.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true, but that's why this, I would say that axiom monotony is an example of something that's theoretically motivated, and so if you can fit both at the same time, right, because it can actually produce such a large R, and at the same time would be able to produce a lower amplitude.
Did they ever build any model that R can go as high as 0.1 in XML?
Well, so it's more like, I think it's like 0.1 is the max, or 0.13 or something.
Point
0.13, right?
No, the highest they can go is 0.2.
Oh, it's 0.2.
Yeah, they were coming like 1 month after the bicep.
Right. Of course. Yeah. What?
They had driven a string theory.
Right. That was the one. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, so then you can put a constraint on the on the case constant, which is right in the sort of the ballpark where you trust these type of models.
So
is it that this isn't a particle? This is a different type of axiom.
It
has nothing to do
with it. It doesn't depend on nothing to do with it. It's theoretical.
No, it's just not with that method.
It's a different axiom.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a QCD axiom.
So it's not. It's even just a yeah. It's not even a QCD action. Yeah.
I mean, all you said is just control some of the silicon features, essentially, right?
Right.
That's essentially all you need, regardless of where it comes from.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the breakdown in the beginning in terms of
F is the decay constant.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, but it falls right into the ballpark where you want it to be for this actually for all these analyses of the power spectrum to be valid. So that's good, right? If you would have something that was bigger than M Planck, it works out. So here I just show you the difference. So the red line would be without features, and then the blue line is the corrected one, bringing it down closer to what we observe. And then I also show here the ratio between no features and what I find, and then of course you get this big deviation. Right, so there's just a ratio, so it should be, if they're equal, they're one, right? So what you see is that the red one is the TT power spectrum, right? So there's a big difference of order 20% at low L, right? So low K corresponds to low L. And then there's, so the black one is the tensor line, and this is in matter, right? So in the matter power spectrum, there's something interesting because you don't have any effects from R, and so the deviation becomes even bigger, right? Of course, we have to address this question, what does delta chi square mean for these type of features? And it turns out that if you do these very low frequency one, you actually recover sort of something that is very similar to a delta chi square distribution. So there, delta chi square of 11 does sort of mean almost a 3 sigma improvement, which makes sense, right? Because they're like sort of it's just like a linear correction to whatever you do. And this is was a projection that I did for W first, which is a future experiment. It's going to measure large scale structure. To what extent you could actually measure this deviation, and it's to high significance. Basically, this means a measurement, right? So whenever this line is below 1 and the error bar is below that, would mean a measurement of this effect.
How do you treat nonlinear effects? You'd have to worry about different, you could sort of think of the translinear regime as mainly long wavelength modes stretching or compressing shorter wavelength modes due to like double bench displacement. So I would think that if you put an oscillation that's sharp and long k in the initial conditions, then it would get sort of defaced and smeared out by when you average over many long wavelength regions that expand and contract. Is that?
This is for a long wavelength modulation, right? So it's basically a rescaling of the power on certain scales.
What frequency is this?
So this was for the frequency that I find, which is like omega equals 1 in the primordial plasma spectrum. So I think the frequency, there must be some kind of, I can't remember, there's some relation between the frequency in primordial space and late times. But if you plot it, I mean, you don't see anything, no, here. I mean, there's not like any kind of crazy things. It's really like a long wavelength modulation of the overall thing. But let's discuss this later.
Yeah,
it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Omega part of one, once A gets to be like 1 over the size of the Zeldovich displacements, the nonlinear revolution will wash out the.
Any effect? Yeah, could be. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. So yeah, just to, and then as a final slide, this is not my final slide, sorry. So one thing that we are also working on is the bispectrum, right? And so just in one word, it's difficult, right? So doing the bispectrum with these type of oscillations is very hard. So the bispectrum has a similar form as the power spectrum, so the observed spectrum up to some factors is BL1, L2, L3. Which is just an integral over the primordial bispectrum, which is capital B. Then there's the transfer functions. There's some geometrical functions here, the Bessel functions. And then there's the integral over the line of sight. And so because the signal noise in each mode is not sufficient to actually measure this thing, what one typically does is to measure over all modes. And that requires some template, right? As I discussed before, right? So you just do some convolution between what you observe and a template, and that gives you a number. And of course, if your template is off, right, then you get 0. So that's the whole point. So if you have if you really have a highly oscillatory bispectrum, right? If you would actually test for this in the data, you would not find anything if you use the wrong template because it doesn't have any overlap. And the problem here is that you need a lot of different templates, right? And you need to run this a lot of different times. Another thing is factorizability. So if this thing sort of maps out, so you can do this integral separately for each k, then the thing becomes much more much faster. And for log space oscillations, that's not an easy thing to do. And so what we're doing now is doing this sort of something that is similar to modal expansion, so you just write down your bispectrum in a bunch of terms that are factorizable, and then try to test those to the data. So that's probably the best way to go, but it's a hard thing. And in the end, of course, the ultimate goal is to do a joint analysis, so you would run over the bispectrum parameters, which are very similar in each model to the one that you find in the power spectrum. You get a marginalized distribution over each of these, and that would be the sort of ultimate goal, I would say. So just one sort of ad that I've been working on with Boriana and Renee and Joel Myers at Theta sort of is this consistency condition, right? So given the results of BICEP, there was a lot of debate, mostly sparked by Paul and others, whether, whether the patient is actually falsifiable, right? And so one thing you could try and do is measure these consistency conditions. And people have worked on this also here by looking at future surveys. And so what we try to do is, you know, what can we say today? You know, I mean, already with LIGO, and so LIGO is a ground-based gravitational wave detector, and then the PTA, which is the pulsar timing arrays, can we actually already put some better constraints that we then Planck and BICEP alone? And that's the case. So here we have, if we assume BICEP's results are correct, right, so this is NT versus R, then you actually significantly enhance the constraint on NT. Of course, it doesn't go below zero, right? That's because Planck actually prefers a very high NT. And then if you don't assume anything about BICEP, you just say it's bogus, it's old dust, can we still do something? And it turns out, yeah, you can actually do it quite well. So if you just do Planck plus LIGO, right, there's really no constraint from Planck because R, if R is zero, then basically it's just completely unconstrained. And I think, in principle, this should also be the case for LIGO, but I guess that because NT is so constrained by LIGO, you get this push, and therefore it doesn't really run into very high values.
Is this just an existing data of LIGO or upcoming data?
This is the current data of LIGO, yes. Yeah.
You should be able to do much better in the future?
Well, so the thing that was pointed out actually by Kendrick and Layton, yeah, exactly. You cannot really take LIGO because it's dominated by wide dwarf mergers. So you cannot never use it to constrain NT in full. So this is sort of like the most pessimistic upper limit you would get, right? Because if you include wide dwarf mergers, you get even a lower value, right?
I think that's the least you're thinking of. But LIGO, because the LIGO sensitivity will never get too far below the bound quality you get from the distances, you don't get upper bound on NT will never get much better than this. But you get a lower bound.
So the point is that, of course, when we did this, obviously there's other constraints because you have these massless degrees of freedom, and BBN would actually give a constraint, as does an effective. And so you have to be careful a little bit, which is, so obviously if you have more massless degrees of freedom, your time of equality will change. And so you have to sort of try and figure out which one is more competitive, right? And so what we did here is we show A equality sort of normalized to whatever you would have if you didn't have any tensor modes. And what you see as a function of NT is that depending on the number of e-folds, so basically this number, you can't really see it, but this would just be like the number of e-folds, which is important because it tells you, you know, to what scale you should integrate, right, this whole thing. And so it turns out that if you just have a certain number of e-folds, then NT is already, you know, should affect your A equality at the level of 10%, basically, when it's 0.5, which is exactly the same bound that LIGO gives, right? So you would have to do this more consistently, right? So this is a joint analysis between Planck, BICEP, and other probes. So if you do this for real, you would have to take this into account, that you can actually get it. Constraint that's better already just by A equality. So A equality in this case, we know it's already constrained to the level of 10%. So in that sense, NT is constrained to 0.5 just by A equality. So we have to include this. So we're working on this right now.
It's hard enough to measure R and nanocounting the temperatures. But measuring NT is going to be more difficult.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, I mean, so the paper by Kendrick and they show that you can do this with some BBO, what's it called? BBO, right? Yeah. So, I mean, this is like 20 years in the future.
Years.
How many years?
At least.
Yes. So let's say 20 to 100. Yes. That's like a nice ballpark, I would say.
Well, this won't be around then.
But it's still like then our, you know.
What?
Our sons and grandsons and granddaughters will know it, right? And then we'll.
We
were there when we talked about it.
My grandchildren don't like physics.
Well, okay. Well, Yeah, that's a problem. We have to resolve that first before we can say this. Yeah.
I predict that how far in the future it is depends sensitively on whether there turn out to be detectable gravity waves in the CMB.
Right.
If it is, then it becomes I mean, it's very futuristic for largely political reasons, not so much for scientific reasons. If the science case was enormously strengthened, and also people became aware of the science case, I think it would become a lot less futuristic.
So you say if we had several extra $1 billion, we could more or less do this now?
You know, I'm a theorist. This
your perception is that you.
It had been one of the Beyond Einstein proposals, NASA's Beyond Einstein proposals, along with CMB poll and some X-ray experiment back in 2004, and it was supposed to be the next experiment. At least, So largely because it's the next experiment after LISA. Now LISA has been pushed back 20 years. It's been pushed back like 20 squared years. You know? So
20 squared, that's a lot. Yeah.
It's not clear if you thought about it, if you were going to try to go directly after it today, what exactly how long it would take.
Well, but the answer to his question is, so you go with LISA, if you have a few extra $1 billion flying around, and then probably that will give such a strong backing on the additional wave window that everything will be on the table.
I mean, so the Japanese are currently doing a more like a BBO experiment without doing LISA before. And they indeed are, until recently they were supposed to do their test.
Is it Lightbird?
Their analog of LISA Pathfinder they were supposed to do in a couple of years, and then unfortunately that got canceled. They call it the SIGO. It's very similar and slightly scoped down relative to that.
Right.
According to Nima Kanihamid, China has the right politics and unlimited funds. Maybe they can do this.
That's a good
question. Just call them, yeah.
Real love increasing authoritarian governments on record.
It was not possible because I don't want to defend this interest.
All right, yeah, so this was my last slide. So.
Let me ask them a question about that. So when did you use the LIGO? They have to do it. So basically, you have to fix NT and extrapolate to all the,
Oh, so here you vary over NT. You vary over NT. Yeah, so you basically, you have just one data point when you have LIGO, right? So it just gives some upper limit on the energy density today, basically. And so you just have so the only thing you have to assume is that inflation lasts for 50 e-folds, because otherwise,
That's what I'm talking about, because when you're measuring different multiples into different data sets, writing plans.
Right. They're completely different. Like they're 10 or like they're 20 orders of magnitude apart or something like that.
You have to extrapolate with assuming a particular NT.
Yeah. So of course it just tells you that if you have a power spectrum, this is constrained. If you want to do more corrections to get it better, I think that also this was said in your paper, right, where you sort of said if you really want to measure this correctly, when you get to the limit, you have to include all corrections, right? Also the running of the running, etc. Okay. Yeah, so just as a summary, we introduced this perturbative approach to look through these features. That's very accurate. I've implemented multinets, which makes it extremely fast. And the constraint so far for the log space oscillations, the WF9 signature has mostly disappeared. There's new low frequency signatures, and there's a mild correlation with the lensing amplitude. For the linear oscillations, WF9 and Planck are sort of consistent. And then the question that I try to just answer in his talk is, are these real? And most likely not, and I would say at the 95% confidence level. Bicep would favor a running and a long wavelength oscillation at almost 3 sigma. So that would be interesting if R would stay 0.2. We trust Liam and Eva on their model building that R of 0.2 is actually okay. Then that actually would be a very interesting candidate. That's it, thank you.
Questions for Don?
In those models, is there any, there's also an oscillation in the 10 tensor spectrum, so, but it's not important to fit for it or something?
Yeah, so that's why I showed. Like, so I use this template, which is derived from actually working out the correction to the tensor spectrum, which is you can find in the appendix of that paper. And it's it could be important, except for the fact that there's this sort of, so there's delta and S, but there's also R star over omega, so there's, it's basically suppressed by order epsilon compared to the other oscillations, so it's sort of not very, I mean, it's very small oscillations, yeah.
You want to have a big oscillation down in the temperature, I mean, in the scalar power spectrum at large angle, right? When you're saying resolving the phi sub, you would favor to 3 sigma, you want a dip in the scalar power at
right.
very large scales.
Right.
Does the tensor power have its dip always in phase with the scalar dip, or?
Yeah, so there's a minus sign difference between the two. Yeah. Yes.
And that's good.
Yeah. So, but it's so much weaker. Yeah. So I guess that only if omega is really small, then this would actually become important. But obviously, then it would just be an overall amplitude shift, and your perturbative expansion, which is used to actually derive these kind of corrections, will break down with those frequencies anyway. So. Any more questions?
Let's thank Don one more time.